Yeah, I'm not sure if I should apologize for giving a more astronomical talk here, but I'm afraid I will. But I've picked of the things that I do, sort of the stuff that hopefully appeals most to physicists. Sort of what I will talk a bit about is the work that I've done over the years with students and postdocs in sort of using the Lyman alpha force to constrain a number of physical quantities. And what I will sort of talk most about or focus most on is sort of trying to sort of narrow down a little bit what dark matter might be. And I just saw Neil coming in, and I think he has worked on this a while ago himself. So I hope he recognizes some of the work he has done a while ago and enjoy seeing where that's going. So a lot of what I will be using in my work sort of in terms of data is spectra like these. And is anybody in the audience who knows what Zeta spectrum actually of is? I think in most audiences someone who knows, but I think here it's perhaps not a surprise, even though there are quite a few astronomers here too, so it's actually a spectrum of the sun. This is sort of a poster child of a spectrum like this. The main thing is here that spectral light dispersed. This is in a Schell spectrograph, so you have many orders. This is what a high resolution spectrum actually looks like. So you have a ship like you have in your mobile phone where you disperse a light on, and then you get the many orders, spectral orders, and then you piece it together to get a spectrum. In this case, this is a spectrum of the sun, and here you see all the Fraunhofer lines. And you can do the same with bright objects that are further away and study sort of the material between us and the object, and I will talk about this later. Sort of there's a number of people here I've worked with a lot. So George Becker favors here, James Bolton, a former student of mine, and there were many more people involved that I haven't all listed here. Sort of just to set the scene, I think we are in the lucky position that we sort of have a wealth of data that tells us sort of in which cosmological model we live. And I think sort of what people have most used and what meanwhile is nearly sufficient to determine most of cosmological parameters without any other data sets is actually CMB, and they've seen maps like this many times. And the nice thing is sort of, or maybe not so nice thing is that there's a standard model that sort of is well established and fits all the data over a wide range of times early on when you see at this last scattering surface at high redshift. At intermediate times, if you look at the Lyman alpha forest, and at late times, if you look at the galaxy distribution, there's one relatively simple model that you probably all hate, Lambda CDM, that sort of fits the data all, and unfortunately, sort of there isn't much sign of extra physics in this. This is sort of a relatively simple model where sort of the CDM stands for cold dark matter, and Lambda is the ominous cosmological constant that's needed to fit the data in the Friedmann-Robertson-Walker universe. Sort of the precision of this is sort of steadily advancing, and you've all probably seen the 2015 results. But sort of what is sort of where you can push further and see how this actually holds up and maybe get a clue for what the dark matter may be is sort of is to realize that there's only a limited range of scales over which this model is tested. So obviously from the horizon scale onwards, it's tested, but there's sort of a minimum length scale to which it is actually tested. And depending on how sort of the exploration goes to smaller scales, this could be very different depending on what the nature of dark matter actually is. And if it would actually be a WIMP, what would be maybe the poster child for cold dark matter, there would be many, many orders of magnitude and scale extrapolation where this power spectrum should actually extend. Tested it is only to a limited scale, and sort of the terminology that astronomers use for this is sort of ranging from cold dark matter to hot dark matter to warm dark matter. And depending on what the free streaming of the dark matter may be, sort of if the particles actually are not really cold and have a sort of a thermal-like velocity, you would have actually expecting a power spectrum cutoff at a certain scale. I think the prime example of this that has been discussed a lot in the literature would have been if sort of neutrinos, normal neutrinos, would have made up the dark matter, in which case sort of dark matter would have been hot, and that would have led, if you plot the power spectrum in a way that sort of you get same power per octave on the power spectrum, then there would be have been a cut off of the power spectrum on galaxy cluster scale, and galaxies would have formed by fragmenting of galaxy clusters. We know for a long time that that's not the case, but sort of we don't know actually how much colder the dark matter actually is. So sort of if we can push it to galaxy scales, to dwarf galaxy scales, but as sort of at some stage there could be a cutoff in the power spectrum and we would just not know because we haven't probed these scales yet. And sort of this talk is sort of about establishing how far you can push that limit and basically sort of answer the question how cold dark matter actually is empirically. And I will try to convince you that using these kind of high resolution spectra, if you take them from distant quasars, is actually our best means of putting the best limits how far you can actually push this and actually establish that the power spectrum of the density fluctuation is actually looking like the lambda CDM model that sort of people have established at larger scales. Sort of, as I said, cold dark matter, and I was told I should actually point here rather than do this, so I will try to do this. So if you take cold dark matter, this would mean for an astronomer that the free streaming scale is so small that it's astrophysically irrelevant. This is obviously a somewhat fuzzy definition, but this is sort of what people do. Warm dark matter free streaming may be important on galaxy scales, and hot dark matter we've already excluded. That would mean that it's actually relevant on galaxy cluster scales. So there's a whole range of warm dark matter candidates where the free streaming length would be such that it would actually affect galaxy scales, and I will show you later pictures how that looks like, how that actually affects galaxy formations. So the one possibility would be that this is the early decoupling thermal relic. This would be sort of a cousin of the neutrino that basically would decouple when it's non-relativistic, but at somewhat later times than the neutrino. One candidate that has become very popular are sterile neutrinos. So under certain conditions, they would produced in a way that they would just have a free streaming length that they would qualify as warm dark matter in the sense that I've just defined. Gravitinos would be another possibility, and there are many more. And I think Neil Turok has written a nice paper together with Paul Bode and Jeremy Ostreicher now 15 years ago, where they sort of discussed this and sort of went through a similar exercise that I'm going here through today. And at that time, sort of tried to put limits that were somewhat weaker than I will show here today. So this is sort of showing what actually free streaming of a dark matter particle would do. So this is here a simulation box where in this case has modeled dark matter and actually the gas as well in a box of a certain size. So this is a hydrocode with a 30 megapassing curve moving box, in this case at redshift 3, where you can observe the Lyme alpha forest best. And what you see is that in the left picture, what's modeled is lambda CDM. And the smallest structures that you see, they are actually set by the resolution of the simulation. So sort of there would be even structure on smaller scales if I would have a larger resolution to do the same simulation. But this is sort of the kind of cosmic web you would expect for lambda CDM model at the resolution where this simulation is done. On the right-hand side, you see the same simulation, but now with a cutoff in the power spectrum due to the free streaming. And then the particles are put in, and this free stream is actually explicitly simulated. And in this case, the warm dark matter or the cutoff is parameterized by the mass of that a thermal relic would have. So the larger the mass of this particle, the more similar it would be to CDM. So what you see is in the right picture, there's clearly much less structure, and that's due to the erasure of the free streaming that converges at late time for a relic like this. And this sort of washes out the small scale structure, and there's much less structure. And this is sort of what we want to sort of see if the universe looks more like this or this. And we have pushed that to much larger masses and things that are much more similar to lambda CDM, but I've picked here a relatively small mass just to make the visual impression how that would look like. This is sort of what it would look like at redshift 3 and looking at the cosmic web as a whole. So if I change the power spectrum, this will have a large effect on what one of these knots in the cosmic web, what we would call a halo that hosts the galaxies, would look like too. So here you see sort of an example of a lambda CDM model and a warm dark matter particle, in this case, a little bit larger mass. And you see what the difference is that sort of the small scale structure that's missing there translates into a missing of smaller objects too. So lambda CDM would actually predict welds of very small mass halos. And if you think that would be, for example, our own galaxy, then lambda CDM predicts that there would be lots of smaller halos around it. And if these would form stars, that would mean there should basically be welds of smaller galaxies that sort of accompany our own galaxy. And in warm dark matter, that might be sort of much less so. This is sort of the modern version of this that has been run in Durham, where they sort of, for a while, sort of specialized in running lots of these simulations. This is now much higher resolution, a similar warm dark matter particle mass or free streaming links. And this gives really nicely the visual impression that lambda CDM predicts a lot of small scale structure, where we are not sure if they're there. And we had this morning a talk where it was discussed sort of how you can, with galaxy formation physics, actually make this picture, what you see on the left, consistent with what we see around our own galaxies, where you only seem to see a handful of galaxies rather than the thousands of small, what we call dark matter halos. I think you would think in principle that's very easy to tell the difference between the two, but because of this complicated galaxy formation physics, it's anything but. And I will try to convince you that therefore you should go back to the Lyman alpha forest to do this. So there are potential problems with cold dark matter that sort of, there have been whole conferences that were devoted to be discussing the small scale crisis of CDM. That was before the lambda came into the CDM. And I had shown you visually what CDM, where the problem may lie. It may predict too many halos, and it may also sort of predict, if you look at the density profile of an individual of these dark matter halos, that these halos are actually too steep at the center. That's what people call a cusp. And these cusps, it is claimed, are actually not observed as predicted if you don't, at least if you don't take account for the complicated baryon physics as well. This is sort of the debate that has bubbled up again and again over the last two decades or so. And the latest incarnation of this is called the too big to fail problem, you may have heard too, that basically sort of where people have concentrated that in particularly CDM predicts too massive satellites around other galaxies, including our own. Sort of this is what I've just alluded to, this too big to fail problem. What's plotted here is sort of a way of measuring the masses of satellites, and how people do this is that they actually measure how fast stars rotate in these potential welds and take that as a measure of the mass. And the visual impression you get here is that sort of in the one model, these curves are all above the observed points, and the other model with the warm dark matter, they come lower. People have taken this as an indication that in warm dark matter there more diffuse and less massive satellites, and therefore that may fit better. There's a lot of debate going on if you could modify the structure of dark matter by sort of moving baryons around and maybe resonantly heat the dark matter in the cusps of these dark matter halos, and that therefore this has nothing to do with actually the nature of the dark matter. So I would claim this is just very massive physics, and this is not a good way of actually putting constraints on the warm dark matter. So this brings me to sort of what I would advocate as sort of as the best way of actually constraining the free streaming links. So I will now sort of give an introduction to what the Lyman alpha forest actually is, and then sort of build up to how we actually measure the free streaming links or get a limit on the free streaming links from the Lyman alpha forest. So sort of the main idea there is that you look at neutral hydrogen in absorption. So neutral hydrogen sort of can resonantly scatter Lyman alpha out of the line of sight, and that will later, as I will show, lead to sort of a forest of absorption line in distant objects just due to the neutral hydrogen between us and the object. So this is to just show basically how well this neutral hydrogen traces the underlying matter. So this is sort of an old compilation that Matteo Fiel has done, and what you here see is sort of the cosmic web of dark matter. And then here there are different panels that show the gas, that traces the dark matter very well, but is a little bit more fuzzy, a little bit less resolution, and this is just due to the pressure of the gas. This is, if you use galaxy catalogs, you get sort of a discretized version of the underlying matter distribution. And nodal hydrogen actually traces the gas distribution and the dark matter distribution very well. This is simple physics. The gas just settles into the potential wells into pressure equilibrium. And then the nodal hydrogen is basically just set by photonization equilibrium of the gas with a metagalactic UV background. This is something what's well understood and what's easy to model in the computer. And that's sort of what we will do later. And then we compare observed to simulated spectra. So as I said, if we're looking at nodal hydrogen, we sort of need to set the nodal hydrogen fraction at every parcel of gas in our universe. And at that redshift where we do this, basically what we have is photonization equilibrium. So we have to see sort of how the recombinations of hydrogen on the left-hand side are balanced by the photonization. So you have a photonization rate, you have the nodal hydrogen density on one side, on the other side you have a two-body process. The electrons find the ionized hydrogen atoms. They are both in equilibrium, and that's easy to calculate. Then we observe the whole thing in absorption at a wavelength that's 1216 or 1215.67 angstrom times 1 plus Z. And if we want to do that in the optical, where sort of astronomers can work easily, that means we have to go to objects that are at a reasonable distance, so that they have appreciable redshift, and this is typically done between redshifts 2 and maybe 5, in some cases up to 6. So sort of what is a Lyme alpha forest? As I said, what we do is we need now a bright source that we can actually look at, and then we want to look at the nodal hydrogen between us and the source, and then sort of the redshifting of the thing sort of gives us in the spectrum a record along the line of sight. I think Andrew Ponson has made a very nice movie that sort of demonstrate how that works. So what you see here is a sort of a typical quasar spectrum. There is here the Lyme alpha line in emission. Then there's an underlying non-thermal continuum, a few other emission lines. And we will now see what sort of the nodal hydrogen between us and the quasar will do in the spectrum. So what you see here sort of as sort of the line of sight passes away from the object you look at, the intervening nodal hydrogen starts now to put absorption lines blueward of the Lyme alpha emission lines because the redshift is a bit smaller than the redshift of the quasar. So you will now see how a forest of line appears, and this is the so-called Lyme alpha forest. At the same time, you will see other elements absorbing that will appear here, and halfway through the simulation, you go midway through a big galaxy, and there sort of the column density becomes very large, and you will get a very strong absorption systems. So to give you a visual impression how that sort of builds up, you see now as you go along the line of sight, just 1216 times 1 plus Z, you build up the Lyme alpha forest. Here's a Lyme series. This is Lyme alpha, Lyme beta, Lyme gamma, Lyme delta, up to the Lyme limit. On this side, you have you have metal lines that are appearing at different frequencies or wavelengths. And you had seen in the middle what happens if you go through a galaxy. I can stop it at that point. Doesn't work to stop, but you saw just as you went through the galaxy, there is a very strong absorption system appearing, and that the reason for that is that the damping wings above a certain column density take a very broad bit out of the spectrum. And in velocity space, what the spectrum actually is, that shows up very prominently. So this is what a real spectrum looks like. So this was just an animation that Andrew Ponson did. He was a grad student in Cambridge a while back of Max Bettini. And so here you see the emission line of the quasar, and then you see here this forest of lines. And if you think that is noise, then you're completely mistaken. This is all signal. I will show you in the next slide how well actually these things are measured. This is now a spectrum as before, normalized. So you had seen these emission lines, and there's a complicated sort of spectrum that's just set to the accretion physics of the quasar itself. If I sort of do a fit for what the quasar has emitted before the absorption and divide through it, I get now the same spectrum normalized to 1, and just have the absorption features just purely there. And this is now the same spectrum blown up factor 100, 2 times 10 in wavelengths. So what you can see here is sort of at the spectrum that's most blown up, you see the level of noise. So this is very high resolution, high signal to noise spectrum, and you hardly see any noise there. So at that level, you actually get the neutral hydrogen record along the line of sight through the whole spectrum. So it's all signal. There's hardly any noise visible in a spectrum like this. So there's an awful lot of things you can do with this, and I will, as I say, concentrate just on how to use that to sort of get the power spectrum of the neutral hydrogen and how to translate that into the power spectrum of the underlying dark matter and look for the cutoff in the power spectrum if there's one. Sort of, if you really want to do that quantitatively, the density distribution is quite complicated. It's this cosmic web that you sort of gets just due the evolution of gravity. If you set up the linear power spectrum that you have observed at the last scattering surface at late times, that will become nonlinear and form this cosmic web that you will have seen many times. So this is sort of our latest efforts to simulate that well. So you put that into a supercomputer, and then you take a certain fraction of the size of the universe that you simulate, can burn a lot of computing time this way. And I don't know if I should maybe briefly show you that. Ewald has produced a small movie of this. I think you have probably seen many simulations of this. These actually focus on getting the Lyman alpha forest right, having the right resolution, and just get the gas before it falls into the halos of galaxies. And they were specifically run for this purpose. Yeah. Sure. Yep. Yes and no. I think for the kind of stuff what I'm talking about today, it's a nuisance. So we would take that thing out. This is actually a very tiny space in real space. It's just a little knot, a little galaxy. But in this spectrum, it looks so prominently because it has these damping wings. So it takes in this spectrum, it takes maybe 5% of the total spectrum. While the space that the gas is sitting is very small. If I want to study high redshift galaxies, that's not a nuisance. It's basically what I'm looking at, because what I'm looking at is the interstellar medium of a high redshift galaxy. We have now lots of spectral information and can study the galaxy in quite some detail. So the answer is yes and no. So if you wonder why there are so many astronomers here, this week, I think this is because EVRY has sort of invited a number of us to discuss a certain aspect of what he's interested in, and this is sort of astronomical objects called blazars that produce gamma rays. And why I'm here is there's a possibility that these actually heat the gas. And what's plotted here from these simulations of the ones that I've just shown here is temperature against density relative to the mean for different models, and I don't want to say any more about this, but that's the reason why there was a little workshop here where we discussed these blazars and their effect maybe on the IGM as well. As I said, with the spectra that I've shown, you can do a lot of different things. You can look at the metapower spectrum, and just from the questions that was just asked, you can look at these DLAs and look at high redshift galaxies. You can look how these galaxies expel material into the environment because you have information on the ionization state, on how the gas moves, and on what kind of metals there are in. You can look at the ionization state of the IGM, as the Lyman alpha forest sort of probes the neutral hydrogen. You can look at the temperature from the width of the features, and if you push to higher redshift, you can study ionization. I will almost exclusively sort of focus on the first bit and talk a little bit about these two and nothing else. So how do we do this? To do that well, I think we have to model the gas distribution well, we have to get high-quality spectra to do this too. So on the one hand, this part of the people in the collaboration go to a big telescope. They get spectra like these that look originally like this. Then if you process them, you get an observed spectrum like this. We have a record of the neutral hydrogen. And then we do our best job to do the same what you would get if we put the ingredients in the universe as we sort of think there should be. And what we vary in this particular task is the meta power spectrum and see how the spectrum changes. So we take a big computer, simulate a patch of the universe, shoot lines of sight through, and calculate what the spectra would look like. So we compare the two statistically and try to constrain what kind of power spectrum we have to put in here to match that best. So this is sort of how that looks for a spectrum. So this is now just varying the free streaming length of the dark matter particle or the input matter power spectrum and keep everything else fixed. And what you see as you increase the free streaming length is that the spectrum gets somewhat smoother. And if I take now a Fourier transform of the spectrum, I can sort of see what kind of fluctuations there are in the flux of this observed spectrum. And this should translate one-to-one into the matter power spectrum that's underlying. And I use my numerical simulation to calibrate this. And this way, we actually get a constraint on the free streaming length. This is a result from work like this from a number of people, including our group and a group from Uwe Schelcher, who has worked on that 10 years back, and for a range of spectra. So what's plotted here now is a Fourier transform of this flux distribution. So this is sort of how wiggly these spectra are on different scales. So here's the power of this Fourier transform of the actual spectra, and here's a wave number. So there's large scales here and small scales here. And these are spectra that are taken with a small telescope and lots of them. And these high quality spectra that I have shown before that go to the smallest scales that are shown here on the right hand side. And what you see here is that this cutoff in the meta power spectrum due to the free streaming, that sort of translates into a cutoff of the flux power spectrum as well. And here sort of is a CDM model and one with a certain mass of the warm dark matter particle. That corresponds to certain free streaming lengths. And what that does is it smooths out the smallest wiggles. And therefore, the power spectrum at the smaller scales actually goes off. And this is sort of the limits that have been obtained there. Then later on, we put a limit of sort of 4 keV that corresponds to a certain free streaming lengths. And this is always the equivalent mass of a thermal relic. The best constraints you actually go get by going to the smallest scales. This is sort of where the free streaming hits in, and the way sort of it turns out, you actually get the best constraints if you go to the highest redshift 2. So the reason why we sort of get here better constraints in this way is that we actually, thanks to George Becker or his supervisor Wolf Sargent, had a sample of 55 keck spectra that went all the way to redshift 5.5, and in this way you could sort of push the constraints to much longer free streaming lengths or larger dark matter particle mass, warm dark matter particle mass. So sort of to give you an impression of what goes in there, this is sort of a sample of these spectra. This is how we simulate them. This is sort of always an observed spectrum and a simulated spectrum. This is here one at redshift 6. This is one at redshift 5. And we go to quite some lengths to put all the artifacts in because we use the spectra for a lot of other things. Here we, for example, have measured the photonization rate close to the quasar to get a measure of the photonization rate at this redshift. This is a sample we have, or that George Becker had for this work, 55 spectra, each about a night on a 10-meter telescope. So this is not a cheap exercise to do. And if you really have this excellent data and accurate simulations, that's where the good constraints come from. Another thing you have to worry about is sort of what the temperature of the gas is, because you're looking obviously for sort of a cutoff in the power spectrum of the flux, and it's not only the free streaming of the dark matter that affects that. The temperature of the gas at some stage will lead to a cutoff too. And this is just the whizzing around of the particle itself. So this is a real temperature. This is not the underlying dark matter. This is really the temperature of the stuff that does the absorption. And this leads to a cutoff in the absorption itself. Nicely enough, sort of the cutoff that you get this way looks different from the cutoff that you get from the free streaming. And therefore, you can sort of, despite the thermal cutoff, you can still get good constraints on the free streaming. Nevertheless, you want to have the temperature right so that you get your quantitative constraints right. And I think this is some results that George Becker had from actually looking at the width of the lines in a certain way and measure the temperature as a function of redshift. And I want to show these results too. And this is done in a way that you sort of at different redshifts, you measure the temperature actually preferentially at a different density relative to the mean. And this tells you in the end, if you're sort of more astrophysically inclined, something about helium ionization. And if you assume something about how temperature and density relate, this you can transform that into temperature at the mean density. And then you may start to see a peak here that corresponds to when quasars probably reionize helium. We also looked sort of at temperature measurements and looked at other people's temperature measurements. And I think this is something what we now reasonably well understood, and sort of this little red arrow that you saw falling down here on the points. And you see this gamma and this gamma correspond, and they correspond we took sort of as a measure of that we understand that reasonably well, that we know sort of A, what the temperature of the gas is, and B, how the temperature depends on density, so that we sort of are not mistaken about the thermal state of the gas and that it will not affect negatively our measurement of the free streaming. This is sort of a plot to convince you what the difference is between actually changing the temperature of the gas and changing the free streaming. So here's sort of a change of the dark matter free streaming, and then I show you what the thermal changes are as well, and they're distinctively different. These cutoffs are very different for the two, and for this reason, you can actually, despite that both of them lead to a cutoff in the power spectrum, the shape is sufficiently different that you can actually get a good measurement. The other thing what sort of is important for this is that you get sort of in your simulations the same mean flux level as observed, and you want to calibrate that to a much larger sample than you actually have. And there, George has done a lot of work too by taking this large sample of spectra and measure actually the mean flux level that's here encoded as an effective optical depth. The mean flux relates to the effective optical depths like e to the minus tau effective. And he has done a very nice measurement of this. And in this way, we have been able to establish a photonization rate very well. This is work that a former student of mine has done. And they basically use that the optical depth is proportional A to the recombination rate and B inversely to the photonization rate to actually infer the photonization rate. And in this way, he got a very nice measurement of first the photonization rate and then the emissivity of the ionizing radiation. This is probably of less interest for the physicists here, but that's sort of interest for people who actually want to know how many ionizing sources there are. And I spent a lot of time to actually extrapolating this to higher redshift to learn how the universe became reionized. And this is just to briefly mention to sort of what you can do with these spectra too. This emissivity corresponds to about 1 to 2 ionizing photons per hydrogen atom, and we call that sort of photon star after ionization. So now a few words sort of on the best measurements we have. So sort of when we did that in 2008, I think that became quite popular, got a lot of attention, and especially as people sort of get more and more interested in stereo neutrinos and wanted to have limits on this, they sort of really wanted to know if they should believe the results. So after a while, we actually went back and sort of got a better sample of spectra, really looked carefully into our systematic errors, and did an extensive scrutiny of the systematic errors and repeated the whole analysis. And in the end, this is sort of the value we came out with now 2 years ago or 2.5 years ago. And sort of these values that had been floating around to actually be necessary to solve this small scale problem with the satellites, we could clearly exclude. And I think this has really been accepted now as sort of the constraint on the free streaming lengths. And this is sort of where we stand of this. And this is sort of what I wanted to show. This is silicon 3. Oh, okay. And that you have to model. So this is a metal line that has nothing to do with the Lyme alpha forest. This is in the data. And the way that's dealt with in the comparison is that you by hand introduce a silicon 3 into the simulations too. So this is a feature. And this is, in a sense, there are metal lines in the spectrum too. And they're not all on the red side of the line. There's some on the blue side of the line too. And as the data got better, people just couldn't fit it. And then they realized that this is a silicon 3 feature. And you can deal with this. And you basically just model this as well. Yeah? This is sort of an artifact that you model. Sort of this plot that Neil may recognize from his paper with Paul Bode, and I've sort of put the constraint on that we sort of get these days. So we get down all the way that sort of all the halos in Lambda CDM might actually be there down to 10 to the 9 solar masses. So the way I would phrase it is that there's very little room left for that warm dark matter still is interesting for galaxy formation. All the halos that CDM predicts are down, are actually there. And the spectrum actually looks like Lambda CDM all the way into the thermal cutoff of the Lyme alpha forest. And it will be not easy to get any further than this because there's just no signal anymore. I think the most promising bit is maybe looking at 21 centimeter emission at some stage. That's very far into the future. There you can look at the gas before it's photoheated, so it's much cooler, so the thermal cutoff would be at much larger, at much smaller scales. Another thing what people look at into is now small scale structure tested with lensing. That might sort of go into the regime of the halos where you're not affected by the sort of photoheating temperature. With this particular method, you will not get further to what corresponds to the thermal cutoff where you basically lose all the signal. Sort of other people have picked up on this, and this title sort of sums it up. The end is nigh. I think this didn't pass the editor, this title. I think when I looked it up, it had changed title. But this also concluded that there's very little room left once you go to 3 keV. I think once it looks like 3 keV, it looks like Lambda CDM for galaxy formation purposes. This is sort of what the Dermot group has tried. So they had a set of these simulations, and they said you would think it's a piece of cake to tell the difference. It's not at all. I think Till will tell you sort of how complicated it is to actually turn this prediction into prediction, how many galaxies there actually should be. These dark matter halos are actually frustratingly inconspicuous. Sort of, they can be there and nevertheless very hard to see or to have any impact that's sort of noticeable. Sort of, if the universe looks like this or this by looking at our galaxy, our own local group, it is just very difficult to tell. Sort of one thing that the Durham group learned the hard way is sort of that you have to marginalize over all parameters. So they had some constraint on this, but then they realized that sort of if you change the mass of the Milky Way, then sort of you can wiggle out of all constraints you have again. And I think now they're sort of really doing what they should have done before they actually do the baryon physics in. And sort of if you really do it once the halos are nonlinear, you're completely degenerate with the galaxy formation physics and small halos. So I would say sort of this attempt was sort of maybe not the best way of trying to actually constrain warm dark matter. Just to summarize our result again. So maybe a short word on sterile neutrinos. I think sterile neutrinos sort of look like dark, warm dark matter, but they have sort of a very rich phenomenology. So they couldn't be warm dark matter. They can have more complicated spectra as well. And they can just be mixed dark matter as well. So they can have a component that's warm and a component that's cooled as well. So I think the way I phrase that is sort of, you are not ruling out sterile neutrinos that way. So if a set sort of warm dark matter is out for galaxy formations, that by no means means that sort of, that you have ruled out sterile neutrinos. Sterile neutrinos are definitely versatile enough that there's plenty of parameter space left where sterile neutrinos can survive. What sort of ruled out is sort of the simplest version of it, if you sort of what they call the non-resident production mechanism. There basically the window between what you get from X-ray constraints and what you get from the Lyme alpha forest, they sort of close up together. And I think this is sort of ruled out. So you have to get to somewhat more complicated versions of actually producing your sterile neutrinos, but there's still plenty of parameter space left for stereo neutrinos, so I don't want to sort of people to go away thinking that they've set sort of warm dark matters out and stereo neutrinos sort of are sort of constrained by the Lyman alpha force in a serious way. So the way I like to summarize this part of the talk is that it appears doubtful that we have seen any astrophysical effects of warm dark matter, that we can put constraints on the free streaming length, but we can't really exclude it. We can just only put it to the limit where it doesn't become interesting anymore for galaxy formation. If it would be what you may call lukewarm, we would still not know. We cannot rule out stereo neutrinos. They could just be cold dark matter or a mixture of cold and warm dark matter with so little warm dark matter that it doesn't show up. But the window for stereo neutrinos to act in the regime where it's astrophysically relevant, I think this is sort of more or less closed. Sort of the rest of my time, I wanted to talk a little bit about what sort of may come in future, and sort of talk about a few other things. And I could, for a while now, interested a little bit in instrumentation, and I will sort of explain you a little bit what's going on there too. So the telescopes that actually get these spectra I talked about so far with is these guys here, the VLTs, that's the European version, and the Keck telescopes in Hawaii. And sort of the next big player will be what's called the EELT. So sort of ESO has just gone once more out of its way and sort of being imaginative in naming a telescope and going from the very large telescope to the extremely large telescope. But this is sort of something what really is becoming reality now. And in Europe, they like to show a plot like this to sort of show how big it is. If I went to New York, I showed this plot. I couldn't find a Canadian equivalent of it. I think ESO is obviously not so much into attracting Canada into ESO anymore as it was a while ago. Sort of to say that it really becomes reality is sort of this is a map where that thing will go. So these telescopes that I've just shown, they are sort of located in Paranal. This is sort of in the Chilean mountain desert where it's very dry and has good conditions for telescopes. So identified another mountain where this telescope will go. And they have actually already taken off the top of the mountain. So this is a project that's really underway, and it looks if at the moment is actually doing better than its main competitor, the TMT. I said I'm involved in instrumentation. This is sort of a timeline, 2024. We hope to have this telescope. The instrument I'm interested here is called High Resolution Spectrograph. And the reason why I sort of put that in again is we will actually have next week on Tuesday, we'll have our kickoff meeting to build a new shiny big high resolution spectrograph for this new big telescope. So it's hopefully there in 2024. And the spectrograph hopefully not too far after this. This is a consortium. This was initially called Initiative. We formed now a consortium. It's probably far too large after the phase A study. That may, at least in the technical contributions, have to be trimmed down a bit. The sort of kind of spectrograph we want to build is sort of modeled on a very successful spectrograph on the VLT, not the one the spectra were taken off that I showed you before. This is sort of a picture of X-Shooter. And what we want sort of what we're proposing is to have a modular spectrograph that covers all wavelength ranges. And we may have to sort of, due to lack of money, start with two of these models in the beginning, but that will be the outcome of this phase A study. There's a wide range of science cases for this. What's maybe the most exciting science case of this is the sort of the exoplanet science case. This may actually be the instrument that may establish sort of signs of life in the atmosphere of a suitable candidate. You will need a spectrograph like this to actually find the biomarkers that you hope to see in a Earth twin. Other things that you can do with this is sort of on the fundamental physics side, is looking at the variation of fundamental contents, and I will show you a few slides at the end of it. So the other thing what's happening in spectroscopy is that finally sort of modern physics arrives at these spectrographs too. So sort of, you may believe it or not, but sort of the calibration of the wavelengths of these astronomical spectrographs is still done sort of with calibration lamps, as have been sort of been devised more than 100 years ago. They have certain spectral lines that are not evenly spaced, and sort of then by sort of having a comparison spectrum from the calibration lamp, you get sort of your wavelength calibration. Where that really hits you is if you want to do precision spectroscopy, and there are two things where that's important. For example, for finding exoplanets with a radial velocity technique, just due to the Doppler wobble of the planets on the star, you need actually, if you want to find an Earth-like twin, a 10 centimeter per second precision. This is sort of much better than even the best spectrograph, or not much better, but a bit better than the best spectrographs can do now. And another thing where wavelength calibration plays an important role is if you want to basically put constraints on variation of, for example, the fine structure constant that sets the wavelengths of these transitions. And if you want to test this, you need a good wavelength contribution too. So the exciting thing is that people have now devised very nice calibration sources, and there's something what's called a laser frequency comp, where you can reproduce a much better calibration source, and that's what it looks like. This is what's called this astro comp. We have equally spaced lines that are perfectly reproducible and even measurable in absolute sense. This is what a calibration lamp looks in comparison for this. So you can easily imagine that using this as a calibration source works much, much better than trying to use this with this sort of very variable intensity, variable distance, and lots of legs in between. So this is really something what will take off on the next generation of spectrographs, and there is one built for the VLT in the moment called Espresso that will come on the telescope hopefully next year, and this will certainly go also in this high-res resolution spectrograph. So the last few slides, I will sort of just try to summarize what kind of controversies that could solve. I think you may have sort of heard about this claim that the fine structure constant is varying. This is sort of very controversial in the astronomical community, but sort of a bit more than 10 years ago, the Murphy et al. And John Webb came out with a result where they claimed by looking at the relative position of the lines that the fine construction must have sort of varied between now and then. And then they took it even a step further when they sort of found that sort of the VLT actually didn't confirm with a similar sample of spectra such a variation. While the Keck sample had it, they just realized that they're looking at different hemispheres. So they put all measurements ingeniously together so that they claim there's not only a time variation, but a spatial variation too, so that in one hemisphere you see a larger effect than the other. You may believe that or not. This is certainly something what the spectrographs will sort out, because this is basically dominated by calibration errors. And the calibration will not be an issue anymore with these new calibration sources. So this will be settled. If true, it will be confirmed. If not true, the limits will be pushed further considerably. Why is that exciting? I think this is probably more for the people here, but they're sort of simple models where you sort of connect the dark energy with the variation of the fundamental constants. So if you could really see a variation in the fundamental constants that sort of chimes with a variation in the W parameters that's parameterized for varying dark energy, I think that would be really exciting and would give probably handles on what the underlying particle physics model is like no other. This is probably a model that people here consider absolutely nuts, but I think this is just the kind of thing you may want to hope by just measuring spectra very well. I think in astrophysics, I think measuring spectra well, I think has broader quantum physics. So I think there's a good case to whatever it is to just measure the spectra well, and you will see what you find and then make out of it what comes. So sort of I'm at the end of my talk. Hopefully in 10 years' time, there will be this telescope, and that's it.
So Marty, if we have some star formation in your warm dark matter filaments or sheets, that can generate velocity disturbance that will also affect the small scale structure of your normal forest. And then that will complicate the problem, right? Is there any?
As you know, we run simulations with feedback too. We have run simulations with monster feedback as well. The effect is basically for this purpose absolutely negligible, and it's easy to see why. A, the volume affected from feedback is very small anyway, and it goes from the dense region straight into the voids, and sort of you never really disturb the filaments and sheets as a whole. And you can test that, and you can just crank the feedback up as much as you want. So this is sort of not an issue. And the way we deal with it quantitatively is that we sort of even marginalize over this.
Yeah, I don't know exactly. You know, Tom Toons and Liang Gao, they suggest that you might form a lot of stars when the gas in the filaments and sheet got cold. I don't know whether your simulation also can deal with that.
As I said, to the best of our knowledge, we have sort of generously marginalized over this. I think the nice thing about the Lyme-Alpha forest is that it's a volume-weighted measure, and volume-weighted, I think the feedback is sort of completely down-weighted in the Lyme-Alpha forest. It's very hard to affect the Lyme-Alpha forest with this kind of feedback that you propose, and sort of even if you put crazy models in, it still sort of has a minor effect.
More? Another question regarding the cutoff. So you, if I understand you correctly, you assume that you have an exponential cutoff due to warm dark matter. Imagine you had self-interacting dark matter, you had some coupling that the dark matter particle after chemical freeze that was kinematically coupled to the standard model via some additional force carrier that would then give you some dark acoustic oscillations which would modify the cutoff behavior and could actually impose into a suppression of formation of structure. Can you make a comment of how these type of models are currently?
This really depends on how your cutoff looks in detail. So if you have a cutoff that, let's say, goes down by a factor of 10, and then what it does below that level doesn't really matter, then you can sort of just take that model and look where your initial cutoff was. If you really just have a cutoff that's about a factor 2 or 3, and then it comes up again, then you will have to run each model separately. I think sort of there are lots of models, different shapes of power spectra. I always sort of tell my collaborators there's only that many models we can test. You have to put a weight to that, how strong you believe that is a realistic model, because it's easy for people to just write down many of these models. But if they sort of not really have a cutoff, then you have to test them separately. If it's sort of a sliding thing that goes down or whatever. But I would say a factor of 10 and what it does then below this, it's the same as having just a full cutoff and going all the way.
Any more comments or questions?
Your warm dark matter simulation is very difficult because you have to suppress the short noise. Now, you think now the simulation result can deal with that very well now, so the result can be
I think short noise is actually only a problem for neutrinos, because at low redshift, the velocities for this warm dark matter particle mass and free stream length is actually very low. Even though they decouple when they're still relativistic, by the present day, the velocities are very, very low for these masses. So it actually makes no difference for the masses where we actually put the constraints if we set up the simulation cold or not. All we need is the shape of the power spectrum. What you refer to is very different if you sort of model neutrinos. The neutrinos obviously move very fast, and then the short noise easily kills you.
No, it's not that, because you don't have power on small scale. And then the short noise that due to, you know, just Poisson noise, if it is initially larger than the true power spectra.
This is a problem if you count halos. And this is a student of Carlos Frenk has looked into that in detail, Mark Lovell. So that introduces you then artificial halos, but they are very far below the actual mass function. But if you want to count objects like they do, you have to take the artificial ones out that are actually not there. We look at sort of at the same scales before they collapse. And that, it sort of, it doesn't make a difference. Sort of this becomes important if you want to do what the Durham group did, count the satellites and compare in warm dark matter to cold dark matter. There you have to basically look into what the short noise produces you in artificial halos. They look different, and what they have done to do this is they have identified the ones that are due to short noise and taken them out. This works reasonably well too, but I agree you have to do this. But for this work, it's irrelevant.
Hi, Martin. Do you have a favorite? I haven't really been following the subject, I have to admit, but do you have a favorite resolution of the dwarf galaxy problem or the satellite problem in CEM?
I think I would probably side with the people that it's bionic physics.
Sorry, I didn't hear that?
I would side with the people that it's just bionic physics.
Just bionic physics. Okay.
It's you remove the halos by the baryons from the halos just by bionic physics. I think we had a very nice talk this morning, the smallest ones. Heating during renization takes care of all the small ones. The slightly bigger ones, it's just supernova feedback. And there has now been quite a lot of work on the CASS problem. And I think people start to be convinced that that really works. And the way it works is sort of if you move gas around in a halo and you don't eject it as initially was thought, but you move it around and you hit the resonance frequency of the halo. So you move it around at the natural dynamical time of the halo. You very efficiently dynamically heat, and the cusps are actually rather fragile. So in this way, you can actually just heat the cusp and it goes away. And what that would predict is that sort of there should be sort of in the more massive halos there should be a cusp. In the smaller ones you can remove the cusp. In the smallest ones there should be a cusp again because there is no movement of the gas because there's not much happening there. And there people claim that they see this. And this is probably the way to settle that observationally. You should see the sequence that where you have feedback you might remove the cusp as you go to halos that are even smaller. You're not able to remove the cusps, you see the cusp again. This is as controversial as 15 years ago.
I see.
And Julia always makes a joke, it depends on the age of the person on the stage, sort of how they interpret that problem. So the younger generation thinks there is no problem. The somewhat older guys still argue.
I see. Is Ben Moore still arguing it's a
Ben
problem?
Ben Moore, as his colleagues say, he doesn't know if he wants to be a rock musician or an astrophysicist. I think lately the rock music has won. No, he hasn't worked on this anymore.
Okay. Since I don't see any more hands, let's thank Martin again.